From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The sentencing phase in the trial of Dylan Roof is scheduled to begin on Tuesday. The jury will decide if Roof should receive the death penalty for killing 9 black worshippers at a Charleston, South Carolina church in 2015. And we'll keep our eyes on that trial. But we want to turn now to another case, this one involving Ronald Gray, a former soldier who was tried in the military court system. His case has been tied up in the courts for more than 2 decades, but a judge recently lifted a stay on his execution. And if Gray is put to death, he would be the first U.S. military execution since 1961. Drew Brooks is military editor at the Fayetteville Observer in North Carolina, and he joins us via Skype. Drew, first of all, start us off by telling us about the crimes that Ronald Gray was convicted of.
Well, it all started with a series of crimes in Fayetteville, which is just outside of Fort Bragg, in the spring of 1986, and at least 5 women were attacked, 3 of them killed, and another was reported missing, and investigators later found her body and identified her as the 4th victim. He was linked to the crime starting in early 1987, when one of his victims who had been raped but not killed went to the police. The next day, investigators on Fort Bragg found the body of Kimberly Ann Ruggles, a cab driver, and later linked Gray to the slayings of Linda Jean Coates, a college student, Tammy Cofer Wilson, the wife of a soldier, and Private Laura Lee Vickery Clay, a soldier and wife of a soldier, who also lived in the mobile home park where Gray lived.
So horrible crimes. He was tried in the military justice system and also tried in civilian courts as well. Is that right?
Yes, he pleaded guilty in civilian courts to 2 of the murders and several rapes and some other crimes as well. The military justice system tried him the next year in 1988, and he pleaded not guilty but was ultimately convicted of the 2 remaining murders and 3 rapes.
Hmm. Well, he received multiple life sentences in those civilian courts, and of course, he received a death sentence in the military justice system. Now, I understand that his execution was supposed to happen 8 years ago, but it did not. What happened then?
Part of the delay between 1988 and now came from a unique requirement of military courts. For a death sentence to be carried out, it actually needs presidential approval. By the time his appeal worked its way through the court system and the sentence was ultimately given presidential approval by President Bush in 2008, a considerable amount of time had already passed. Then, shortly after Bush approved the execution, officials set a date for it, but Gray's lawyers filed an additional federal appeal, and a judge in a court in Kansas, which is where Gray is being held, awarded a stay of execution, and that was in place up until just a couple of weeks ago.
And what was the justification for the stay?
It was meant to give Gray's lawyers additional time to make their appeals and bring up some possible errors that the court system may have allowed during his court-martial back in 1988.
I see. Is he making an argument in his appeal that he still believes he's not guilty?
Well, Gray's lawyers have made about 2 dozen assignments of error in his case, but most of those have to deal with whether the military had jurisdiction to try him in the first place and whether Gray had the mental capacity to stand trial. Most of the attempts seem to be geared towards getting the death sentence lifted, not necessarily overturning the entire conviction.
Well, as you mentioned, it was President George W. Bush who approved Gray's execution back in 2008. And I see in your reporting that Gray is the only person on the military's death row whose execution has received that approval. How many others are on death row in the military justice system?
There are 6 inmates in total on death row in the military justice system. They include Timothy Hennis, which is another Fort Bragg case, slaying of a family in Fayetteville. It involves the Fort Hood shooter, and it involves a few other high-profile cases that have come out in the last couple of decades.
Hmm. Now, in the beginning of this conversation, we talked about how the last U.S. military execution was in 1961, so quite some time ago. Tell us about that. What's the significance that Ronald Gray may be the first person to be put to death in the military justice system in more than 50 years?
I think it speaks to the heinousness of the crimes. These crimes really terrorized the area as they were taking place.
Yeah. And you're there in Fayetteville. How is this case resonating there, since it seems like it's now moving forward to some kind of conclusion?
There are certainly some locals who can remember the terror and the fear that was throughout the community when they were taking place in the late 80s. And others are just, they seem surprised that he's still alive and is still waiting out his sentence. Mm.
Well, Drew Brooks is military editor at the Fayetteville Observer. Drew, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
The election of Donald Trump is inspiring some transgender people to take care of important paperwork. Under the Obama administration, it's become easier to change your gender identification and legal name on passports and other documents. Some people are worried it's going to become tougher under a Trump administration. Hundreds of attorneys across the country have volunteered to help them out. Karen Shikurji from WXXI reports.
At a legal clinic in Rochester, New York, attorney Ann Williams is meeting her 33-year-old client for the first time. She asks him questions about what it's like to have one name and gender legally and another name and gender in real life.
How about when you show your identification?
I've had...
The client takes a tin black box out of his bag. He pulls out a passport, birth certificate, social security card, and license. They all say female, but the client is a transgender man.
They'd use female pronouns instead of male, even when I started coming up with more facial hair. So they've kind of...
The client is here to change his legal name and gender.
So I want to be safe, perceived as who I am, something that a lot of people don't think about, but it's something that when you're different, you think about a lot.
New York State requires that name changes get published in a local newspaper. For safety reasons, the client is asking a judge to waive that requirement, and because of that, we're not going to use his name either.
Especially if we're going into an environment where we're getting more conservative in our country and having a backlash against people who are different, it's nice to have everything kind of match up so that our surface can match our documentation. It keeps us safer, really, in the end.
A new report from the National Center for Transgender Equality found that 30% of respondents ran into problems when they showed an ID that didn't match their appearance. Problems like verbal harassment, being asked to leave a place, or being physically attacked. Mara Kiesling is the executive director of the center.
When you have ID that isn't right, you risk outing yourself as transgender, and there's still a lot of disrespect, discrimination, and violence against transgender people.
Before 2010, only people who underwent gender reassignment surgery could change their gender legally. But Kiesling says under the Obama administration, some federal agencies redefined criteria for changing gender on IDs.
What they've realized is surgery is not a rational way to look at who is what.
The policies changed to include anyone receiving transition-related care, as long as they could provide a letter from a doctor. Kiesling questions why an expert is needed to vouch for them.
But it's still much better than this antiquated notion that everybody has a specific kind of surgery that is uniform and accessible for everybody.
Many transgender people are concerned that option may change or just go away. And that's why legal help is popping up across the country. This session in Rochester is one of three organized by attorney Milo Primo. He works at the Empire Justice Center, a New York State advocacy organization.
The policies we're talking about here are just that. They're policies. They're administrative policies. So the new heads of the Social Security Administration, the Department of State, could easily get rid of those policies.
Primo usually advises about 15 people a month for name and gender marker changes, the female or male designation on IDs. But since the election, there's been a jump in interest. About 50 people from 6 counties in upstate New York signed up for these legal clinics.
You think, okay, does somebody really need a gender marker change with Social Security? What difference does that make? It makes a difference with your ability to access certain benefits and spousal benefits and retirement benefits. It can impact your ability to access Medicaid and Medicare that won't discriminate against you based on your gender marker on your records.
Neither President-elect Trump nor his appointees have made comments about changing these procedures, says Mara Kiesling.
We don't know that these policies would be rolled back. It would it would have to be an intentional attack on transgender people to do it. There would be no real programmatic reason to do it.
But for now, the uncertainty is enough to make people organize.
So if that's all true, you sign there.
Awesome.
Attorney Ann Williams has her notary stamp ready in hand. Her client is now sitting next to her, and they're going over a printout of the application.
Legal name. Correct.
Legal name.
Yep.
He signs his given female name on the dotted line. After his application gets approved by a judge, he'll have to take a letter from a doctor to state and federal agencies to update all of his IDs.
Super exciting. It is.
I'm glad.
He's hoping to do that as soon as possible. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Chakurji.
On this Friday before New Year's, we thought we'd revisit a story about a new beginning. John Elder Robison has Asperger's syndrome, and in his 2007 memoir, Look Me in the Eye, he wrote about how his painful inability to read people's emotions also came along with a spectacular mechanical aptitude that led to a successful life. And it also led to an unusual invitation from researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. They asked him to participate in an experimental therapy that might turn on his brain's ability to see emotions. And even though the effects were temporary, the treatment changed his life. John Elder Robison wrote about the experience in his memoir, Switched On, a memoir of brain change and emotional awakening. And we spoke with John about the book back in March and began by asking him, before the treatment, how much of people's emotions could he read?
Well, you can't really know what you can't see when you can't see it. So the thing is, all through my childhood, other kids told me I was stupid or mental or, you know, they just didn't want to play with me. So I knew that I was missing some component that made me unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, despite that profound challenge that you had a very successful auto repair shop, a profound mechanical aptitude. I mean, you invented the fire-spewing guitars that Kiss is known for now. So you were nevertheless, you were still successful in your own way.
Even though autism crippled me socially and made me isolated and alone, I spent that alone time using this autistic concentration to concentrate on electronics and mechanics, and that made me a star as an engineer and mechanic.
Yeah. When you received this invitation from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center to participate in some innovative brain treatments, what was your first reaction?
Well, the first thing I thought was it was just really cool because they were interested in using pulses of high-powered magnetic energy to change the way our brains are wired. And I had worked in electronics with high-powered electromagnetic energy. That's what we use to drive speakers. Therefore, I understood it and it wasn't scary. And I thought, the idea that we could use that to couple signals into the brain, that's kind of remarkable.
So the experiment involved transcranial magnetic stimulation. And as you describe in the book, it's an electromagnetic field used to induce signals in the outer layers of the brain, hoping to essentially turn on or rebalance parts of the brain that were previously out of balance.
The idea is that you would use the principle of electromagnetic induction to deliver energy to small areas of the brain, areas the size of, say, a golf ball. And that means, for the first time, a doctor could energize or de-energize just a small area of the brain without affecting the rest of the brain.
So tell me more. I mean, what was it like when you were actually undergoing the transcranial magnetic stimulation?
Well, you know, it was really cool. They had told me that the brain doesn't have pain or pleasure receptors. So they said your brain won't feel anything with the stimulation, but you might feel a little bit of a pop from the muscles and stuff and the nerves on the top of your scalp. But what was really weird was even though I didn't feel it inside my head, I could feel it because I'd be like thinking, oh, I got to go get groceries when I leave here. I'm going to count TMS pulses. And I got 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I would just lose my train of thought. I couldn't keep a thought in my head while they did TMS. It just put my mind into kind of a meditative state.
Now comes the big moment. I mean, how long did it take for you to begin to experience an emotional awakening.
I did one stimulation, and I thought nothing had happened to me. And I came out of the hospital, and I got my car to drive home, and I turned on my music player, and I play a lot of times old concert performances and stuff like that. And it, instead of it being like it had been 1,000 times before, it was like all of a sudden the music was alive. It was like I was back there again, and I could hear all this detail, and I could see it. It was just like I was transported back in time, and it was the most overwhelming thing.
Wow. So you're describing a reaction that the TMS treatment engendered in you in reaction to music. What about people, though? I mean, because your previous book was Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's, and now suddenly were you able to read people in a way you hadn't been before?
That stimulation didn't have that effect, but a stimulation a little bit later did do that. And that was really, really powerful, too. It was like suddenly I walked into my work with the people around me, and it was like I had ESP. And I was actually overcome by the stream of emotion from all the people around me. It was actually, even though I had thought that being blind to emotion was a disability for me, having that wave of emotion of everyone wash over me, that was crippling to me.
I mean, it's like a tsunami, really, almost more than a wave, because all of a sudden, every single person around you is transmitting this information, this emotional information that you had never been bombarded with before.
The other thing is that I had constructed this fantasy in my mind about disability, and I had thought to myself, well, because I can't read unspoken cues from other people, then I am missing all of these messages of beauty and sweetness and light. And if only I could see those things, my life would be immeasurably better. But when the ability to see into people came on, I didn't see beauty and love and sweetness and light. I saw anxiety and fear and avarice and all these other downer emotions.
On the tip of my tongue, there's this question of whether or not you're glad you did the treatments, because it sounds like the aftermath of some of it was quite overwhelming.
The aftermath was absolutely overwhelming. I think that what the study showed us for the promise of technology has a value far beyond anything that I could possibly get from it.
So you have no regrets then?
I don't want to say that. I mean, I had some really, really hard times. I was driven to be almost suicidal. My marriage fell apart. I embarked on a disastrous relationship after that, and took 5 years for me to remarry and stable and settle down again. TMS actually changed how I saw my memories as a child. I now remember times that people were laughing, but thanks to TMS, I realized they were laughing at me.
That's got to hurt. You know, I'm sorry, John, because I feel it pains me to hear you say that, because we started this conversation with you saying...
Well, it does hurt.
Yeah.
I agree it hurts.
Yeah, because we started this conversation with you saying that, you know, you remember how painful it was growing up, and it feels like you were just like reliving in a brand new way that pain all over again as an adult after the treatment.
It's true that I'm reliving it after the treatment. I guess I feel like my ability to engage other people, especially people who don't know me, is really fundamentally transformed today. And I don't think that TMS is 100% responsible for that. Certainly I've had, you know, practice and stuff at doing it these last 10 years, but I think that it was a significant thing. And I look at the autism advocacy that has kind of taken over my life, all the time I spent talking to folks like you, writing about it, speaking about it. I can feel pride that that's like the greatest thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, it almost makes me cry, you know, to think of it. But I hurt so much as a little boy. And I wanted so much in my book, Look Me in the Eye, to share a message of hope with young people that they could grow up and life could be okay. And with this experiment that I took part in, this showed me that it can be real. It can happen. And not just for me. It can happen for so many other people that are affected in different ways as we learn how to use this. And so even though I've been hurt by the memories, it means so much to me for that hope it offers.
Yeah.
And that's why I do it, I guess.
Countless people.
Sorry if I seem discomposed at that, but.
John, no apologies. Do you promise? No apologies, because that's what human emotions are, right? We are all complex.
This wouldn't have happened to me 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you don't just get to choose only the good emotions, right? No one gets to choose. We experience the whole gamut of them, all of us. You know, in just talking with you, John, I'm feeling intensely human myself right now, both sort of in a joyful and tragic way at the same time. I should say that John Elder Robison's new book is called Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening. Thank you, John, for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for calling and wanting to do the interview. I wonder what people are going to make of this story when they hear it.
I guarantee we'll be hearing from them, I'm sure.
You know, it's like, the thing is, it's like science fiction, but it's real.
We spoke with John Elder Robison back in March.
The country's second largest union will start to slash its $300 million budget January 1st. The Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, will cut 30% of its budget by January 2018. 10% of that cut will come next week. The union's preparing for what it believes will be leaner and meaner times under incoming President Donald Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress. Here to explain why the union's making such a drastic move is Michael Regan in New York. He is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Michael Regan, the SEIU president, Mary Kay Henry, suggests that the cuts will better enable the union to resist any attacks on it. What is the logic behind such a drastic cut? How would further reducing the union resources, which are already drained, help it fortify itself against opposition?
Hi, Lisa, and that's a great question. I would say that, you know, anyone interested in this topic should check out Josh Edelson's story in Bloomberg Businessweek this week for a lot more information. But I think basically what Henry is doing is trying to run the union as you would any other business and trying to forecast for the future. So the thinking is that Republican-controlled government will create conditions that will cause union membership to fall, and therefore the union's revenue obviously will fall. So this sounds like a way to basically prepare for that so that they don't have to burn through funds too fast and as a result have to make even bigger cuts further down the road.
But Donald Trump talks about some of the same goals that unions do, keeping America's jobs in America or bringing them back from overseas, for instance. Does that provide a bit of solace to the union, this one and others?
Not to the union leadership, probably. I think the actual union members have responded to the Trump platform. In the election, Hillary Clinton beat Trump in union households only by 8 percentage points. And the Washington Post pointed out that's the narrowest lead for Republicans among union households since Ronald Reagan was in office. So it does give you an idea how, like Reagan, Trump has been able to lure a lot of blue-collar workers onto his side.
But at the same time, at least the SEIU sees itself as losing somebody friendly to it in the White House, Barack Obama. What did he do for unions that apparently resulted in some strength for Hillary Clinton among union members, but not enough?
Yeah, so Obama basically sidestepped Congress on a number of issues through executive orders and other means. And he did so, he basically instituted several policies that were considered very union friendly, including raising the minimum wage for federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. And he tweaked the rules to a 1930s law called the Fair Labor Standard Act to basically allow workers at higher salaries to be paid overtime. So the concern is that Trump will come in and overturn some of these executive orders and other moves, and will also appoint a National Labor Relations Board that is much less union-friendly than the one under Obama.
One other question about the cuts, Michael. Where are they going to come? Who will be cut? 30% is pretty significant.
Yeah, I don't think we have a lot of detail on that yet, but it sounds like a pretty broad-based across the board cut in their budget.
Okay, starting with 10% cuts on Monday, New Year's Day. Michael Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
On Monday, the University of Southern California will take on Penn State University in the 103rd annual Rose Bowl. The football game will be played in Pasadena, California, where it has been for every year except one, 1942. Bill Littlefield from NPR's Only a Game explains why that is and how a special bond developed between two men who played in the game that year.
Well, the Rose Bowl wasn't played in Pasadena in January of 1942 because on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and Pasadena was close enough to Hawaii to arouse concern.
And about 6 days after Pearl Harbor, Lieutenant General John DeWitt, who was in charge of the Fourth Army on the West Coast based on the Presidio in San Francisco, made the determination that the Rose Bowl game should not be played. That if that many people were in the same spot, the Japanese bombers were likely to target it and the Rose Parade. So he asked the governor of California to call off the game, which he did.
That's Brian Curtis, who has studied and written about the events of that time, among them the debate over the fate of the 1942 Rose Bowl game.
Many in America were split, and the newspapers nationally weighed in. There were editorials stating that we are now a country of war. Our young boys are going off to fight. The last thing we should be thinking of is playing some silly football game. Then there were other newspapers and Americans that weighed in and said, wait a minute, if we stop playing our games, if we stop living our lives, then the Japanese have beat us, even though they only attacked us in Pearl Harbor and Hawaii.
The latter point of view won out. The 1942 Rose Bowl game was played, but it was relocated to Durham, North Carolina, home of Duke University. Oregon State would play Duke because, as the winners of the Pacific Coast Conference, Oregon State had earned the right to pick their opponent. They chose Duke, the team generally regarded to be the nation's strongest that season. Oregon State graciously agreed to travel across the country for the game. Duke's roster included Charles Haynes, a local boy from Durham.
Charles was a good student, a great wrestler, an okay football player, a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout, whose father worked for the American Tobacco Company in Durham, as tobacco at that point was still the center of life in Durham and much of North Carolina. He matriculated to Duke and played on the football team for Coach Wallace Wade, often found himself more as a cheerleader from the sidelines as opposed to playing.
Among those determined to upset Haynes and his highly regarded teammates was Frank Parker, an imposing Oregon State guard.
Frank Parker couldn't have been farther away, literally and figuratively, from Charles Haynes. Parker was a very poor boy whose father died running bootleg liquor on Christmas Day when he was just 12 years old. At the age of 13 or 14, was helping to pick up trash and drive dump trucks with his stepfather, who actually was his uncle, but that's another long story, and was smart enough and good enough and strong enough to go to Oregon State University and start studying agriculture.
Charles Haynes, the son of a wealthy tobacco merchant, may or may not have had any contact with Frank Parker, son of a dead bootlegger, before, during, or after that transplanted football game in which Oregon State upset Duke before an estimated 50,000 spectators. Shortly thereafter, Haynes and Parker had something else in common. They were both in the Army. Haynes was turned down the first time he tried to enlist. He had to memorize the eye chart to pass the physical. Parker also enlisted, and during what must have seemed an interminable delay, he was shipped from base to base within the U.S. By the early summer of 1944, Haynes was in Italy, fighting for territory, hill by hill, yard by yard. And that's where he crossed paths once again with his former Rose Bowl opponent.
In July of 1944, Frank Parker finally came over to Italy as a replacement soldier. And within a day or two of his arrival, they met. Frank was very shy and quiet, contrary to his large behemoth size. Charles Haynes was always willing to strike up a conversation, and he did with Parker. And very quickly, they realized their connection, that they had both played in this remarkably transplanted Rose Bowl game, you know, at that point, 2.5 years earlier. So they became friendly. They were stationed, obviously, in the same division, almost in the same platoon. So they often were fighting side by side in action.
On a day when the two former rivals were not side by side, Charles Haynes led his company up a hill he'd thought was quiet. He was surprised by a German artillery attack.
So he was wounded, had wounds in his chest the size of a fist, wounds in his leg. It started to rain. It was too dangerous for his fellow soldiers to rescue him. So for 17 hours, Haynes thought he was dying, coming in and out of consciousness. Word had gotten back to Frank Parker, who was in another part of the fight, that Haynes had been wounded. And it was Parker and another soldier that made their way up to the top of this ridge. Haynes was conscious at the time. He recognized Parker. Parker and this other soldier were able to carry Haynes under fire down a hill to a medical aid station.
Parker returned to battle immediately after the rescue. Haynes spent several months in hospital and then returned to his unit. When the war ended, Haynes took up the life of a wealthy young man in Durham once again. He ran a construction business. He opened up a restaurant. He was apparently able to leave behind the horrors of battle. The man who saved his life was not so fortunate.
Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did. In fact, he stayed over in Europe an extra year or so when he didn't have to, because he was so worried that he had changed fundamentally as a person, as a human, as a Christian, that he was not the same person that his wife, Peggy, had married.
Haynes, gregarious after the war as well as before it, thrived in business and in his personal life. He told people about Frank Parker and the exceptional coincidence that had found his former opponent on the football field saving his life on a muddy hill in Italy. Parker eventually returned to Oregon. He rarely told his family anything about what he'd seen and done during the war, and he found adjustment to civilian life as hard as he'd feared it might be.
I think even his children understood at an early age that Dad had issues and at times would disappear into a bar for a day or two. Never hurt his kids, never hurt his family, you know, got into fishing and would disappear for months on end.
Parker apparently felt that absence would spare his family embarrassment and shame.
And it really wasn't until he was about to attempt suicide after his wife's passing, well into his 70s, that he finally went to a VA and was hospitalized for a couple months.
During the years after the war, Haynes and Parker rode each other a few times. Duke hosted a reunion for both teams from the 42 Rose Bowl, but Frank Parker didn't make the trip from Oregon. So Haynes, restaurateur and businessman, and Parker, disappointed fisherman, didn't see each other until October 1991, when Oregon State hosted a 50th reunion gathering for the veterans of the only Rose Bowl game ever to have transpired outside of Pasadena. Haynes was determined to get to that second grand occasion.
Charles Haynes made the effort to cross the country solely to be able to see Frank Parker and thank him. Charles Haynes embraced Frank Parker, gave him a hug, told everyone at the reunion, kept pointing out that this was the man who saved his life. As they read the names of deceased players for Oregon State and Duke, Haynes started to cry and looked across the room at Parker.
Parker presented Haynes with a money clip carved from a whale's tooth, a souvenir of the months Parker had spent at sea as a fisherman. Haynes was the beneficiary of Parker's exceptional courage, and Parker was a hero. Hero is a word too often applied to football players and other athletes who save nobody. But though Frank Parker saved Charles Haynes, he couldn't rescue himself from the consequences of the terrible personal damage he suffered during the war. The unraveling of Parker's life after the war is something Brian Curtis feels shouldn't be forgotten.
We think of this generation as the greatest generation for their heroism, which is absolutely true. What we don't hear a lot about is the homelessness, the divorce, the alcohol, the lack of mental health care that many of these gentlemen got. So Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did, never fully came to grips of the man he became.
Charles Haynes suffered a heart attack and died in 1994, just 3 years after the reunion in Oregon. Frank Parker was eventually diagnosed with PTSD and depression, and he died in a nursing home in 2002. In his new book, Fields of Battle, Pearl Harbor, the Rose Bowl, and the Boys Who Went to War, Brian Curtis explores at greater length the lives of Charles Haynes, Frank Parker, and some of the other young men who went directly from the football field to the war in Europe. For Here and Now, I'm Bill Littlefield.
And on Monday night, ABC brings back The Bachelor for its 21st season. It'll star Nick Vile, and we've got a clip here from the latest trailer.
Three times Nick's walked away brokenhearted.
Don't love me.
Monday, January 2nd, we're giving Nick...
I'm super into you.
...one last shot.
Fourth time's a charm. Question mark?
If you think this season will be smooth...
Well, The Bachelor dominates the TV ratings, but NPR's TV critic Eric Deggan says... this is actually one show to avoid in the new year, and he joins us now. Hi there, Eric.
Hey.
So don't watch The Bachelor. Why? Millions of people do.
Because it's a terrible show.
I served that one up to you,
I am continuing my one-man crusade against this horrible, horrible travesty of television. I mean, aside from the fact that it is this manipulative princess fantasy that encourages women to sort of submit to this really bizarre process. The person that they've chosen, he could have been crafted in a laboratory bottle to be to be the Bachelor. He started out on a season of The Bachelorette where he was, quote unquote, a villain, someone who the audience was not supposed to like. And then he did another season of The Bachelorette with a different woman, but again, he came in second. Then he appeared on a show called Bachelor in Paradise and was once again rejected. And so now this is sort of his shot at redemption. That's his storyline. It's just, you know, it's manipulative. It's not authentic.
I got to jump in here because you know, I completely get it. You are on a very laudable one-man crusade. But, I mean, look, people know there's nothing authentic about it. I mean, it's not the first reality show ever. We've been doing this for a long time. And what's wrong with a little fantasy? I mean, there's all these watch parties that go on around The Bachelor. It's, you know, you come together, maybe you have a drink or two, you watch The Bachelor, and you have a good laugh.
Well, all I can say is that there were large audiences for a lot of shows that I felt were kind of damaging. You know, people loved Cops for a while until they realized how much it fed into stereotypes about working class people and people of color and crime. And The Bachelor not only represents a lot of sort of unhealthy stereotypes about relationships, what women should do to get a man. I mean, all of that I don't like. But I also just don't like TV shows that are not honest with their audience.
So now that you've done a mighty smackdown of my meager defense of The Bachelor, let's move on to something else, okay? There's another show that I hate. Yes.
There's another show I don't like.
Yet another one.
Let's bring them on.
This is from Fox. It's a comedy called The Mick. And we've got a clip here of the trailer. And in it, you'll hear Caitlin Olsen. She plays a woman forced to take care of her wealthy sister's kids, and in this scene she's tricking the oldest daughter into staying in for the night.
I know you think you're pretty clever with this little plan to drink me under the table, but you can't.
Uh-oh. Something the matter?
No, I'm good. I just felt kind of funny for a second.
Funny like you just drank six different types of sleep medication funny?
Why you do that?
My night, princess. I'll help you get into your jams.
Okay, so drugging teenagers against their will, not a very smart start.
Yeah.
Here.
By far, that's the least worst thing that happens on this show. So fans of the show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, will recognize the star. She's playing another character who has a doctorate in making bad decisions, a woman who's kind of a two-bit hustler, but her sister married into wealth. And when her sister and her husband sort of flee the country because they're about to be prosecuted for, I think, tax evasion, the sister has to step up and has to take care of their three kids in this mansion. And so there's a touch of, I don't know, Beverly Hillbillies here about it, where you have a working class woman sort of suddenly giving great wealth. I wish it was funnier. You know, I'm somebody who loves a good fart joke as much as the next person, but this show just has not figured out how to exploit Caitlin Olsen as a really talented comedic actress, and I don't think she's done any favors by this show.
Well, lastly, let's serve up the hat trick of shows that you hate for this segment here. We got one last one. It's called Emerald City. It airs on January 6th, and we've got a little bit of the trailer from that, too.
War is upon us, a clash of science and magic. I woke up in a place I don't belong, but then I found you.
So, Eric, Emerald City, why is it one not on your list for 2017?
Well, you know, it came from a good place. People who have read the book that the Wizard of Oz movie is based on know that the book is darker than the film. But this is a drama. It's not a musical. And I don't think they quite know how to tell the story in a modern setting in a way that is both compelling and that also makes sense. And so the whole time you're watching it, you're sort of asking yourself, you know, why did they feel the need to do this to the Wizard of Oz if they weren't going to pull it off?
Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans giving us ample warning of shows he thinks we ought to stay away from next year. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for letting me vent. I feel so much better now.
At least that makes one of us. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.